Chapter 20 Hopes and Fears. Buckley, Chief Belty's oldest son and heir apparent, wasn't living in the Godfrey area when we first moved in to open our station. This had important implications affecting our relationships with him once he returned to the Godfrey some 18 months after we had first arrived. When he appeared on the scene, he came with a hostile attitude. We had the feeling he wished we weren't there. Our dealings were with Balti. It was he who had assured us of his cooperation, and that he welcomed our coming to the Godfrey. From the beginning, it was apparent to us that Balti had enormous power and influence over his people. At times, it appeared that he had the power of life and death in his hand. When we first arrived, nothing happened without Balti's involvement and approval. If he told people to help us, they helped. When we paid helpers their wages, they counted them out to Balti, and he took a few for himself. During the early months, no one worked more than a day at a time. Usually, it was far less than a day, and no one ever worked by the week. At the end of each day's work, however long or short the day, we had to pay each one his or her wages. Payment was always in 5-cent coins. As we came to know Balti and the Masengo people better, we began to understand their worldview. Masengos believed that the Creator God was far away. They recognized his existence and acknowledged him as the giver of sunshine and rain. However, they didn't worship him, and on a daily basis their concerns were about keeping unfriendly spirits satisfied and at bay. The Masengo had many superstitions. Some were quite humorous. Our son Mark, as a young boy, loved to hike, fish, hunt, and explore with Masengo boys his age. After returning home from one of these hikes visiting villages across the river, Mark shared with us a strange experience. He said that when they came to a certain place where the path suddenly veered off in another direction, his Masengo friends all stopped. They picked up small switches and began to switch their buttocks, threw these switches on a pile in a certain fashion, and then moved on. He said they told him that a leopard had crossed the path there, and they did this to protect themselves from him. In the early days when we were exploring the river for possible sites where we could put up our hydraulic ram to push water up the hill into the station, I had asked Balti to provide a man who could help me research this. Balti kept dragging his feet, so one day, growing impatient, I was able to get one of the men to take me to a nearby fall so that I could check it out. That evening, when we returned, Balti was so furious with this man that he threatened to kill him. I learned that Balti claimed a mysterious power over these falls, and that they had some superstitious views about spirits who resided in that place, who also gave him special powers. The coffee tree incident. Another strange thing occurred when workmen from Tepe located a coffee tree just off the compound. I had told the workmen that I was very interested in learning where wild coffee might be growing. I hoped that eventually we might be of some help to Masengos in helping them grow coffee as a cash crop. On this occasion, Levine and I had just returned from our first trip out to Addis Ababa with the MAF plane. Upon our return, the workmen from Tepe were excited to show us a coffee tree that they had located nearby. In fact, they had already planted several volunteer seedlings that they had found growing near this tree. When they showed me the tree, I was surprised at how scrawny it looked and decided I should prune it so that it would become more productive. I thought nothing more about this, as the tree was actually growing in the midst of vines and brush just off the compound. It wasn't long, however, when we discovered that Balti wasn't at all happy with what I had done. I had no idea that this tree was anything other than a wild tree growing in the forest. I learned differently when Balti and his man Alamayu and I pushed our way through the undergrowth to visit this scrub tree, which was only about 10 feet tall. I was astonished to see these two men kneel down and begin talking to unseen spirits. I learned that it was a sacred tree, which had connections with someone who had died long ago. I never fully understood but it was apparent that it was more than just a wild tree growing by itself. They thought that I had been disrespectful when I cut off its branches. I don't know whether I was fully successful or not in trying to indicate that I had pruned it so that it would produce coffee beans. They had no interest in harvesting coffee from it, and I am not sure they believed what I tried to explain to them. My usage of Masengo language at that stage didn't make for the most efficient or certain communication. I did know one thing, however, and that was that Masengo saw things far differently than I did, and that I'd better learn all I could about them if we were to communicate the gospel to them effectively. Balti, chief and ritual expert. The Melanir clan, to which Balti and other less important chiefs or ritual experts belong, were considered to be gods and to have power over the spirits. On our survey trek when I made my first contact with the Masengos, I had asked an Anuak-speaking Masengo in the Kortomi area what the Masengos believed about God. We were walking along the trail, 15 or 20 feet behind the leader, the Masengo chief in that area. Pointing to the chief, he said, "Padwaka Eni? Is he not God?" In Balti's village, there was a typical shrine with the emoi plant. It had some stones, a broken pot, and another that seemed to be still intact. There were a few scattered beads, and that was about all there was to it. And when they made beer, a little of the new beer was always spilled first on those rocks. I was told that this was to honor and keep the ancestors happy. Balti performed numerous sacrifices of chickens. People would come in carrying a chicken. At the appropriate moment, Balti, who had bad-looking legs with skin ulcers that never completely healed, would come out of his hut or arise from his stool. He'd point to his spear leaning up against the grass fence. Someone would fetch it. All was very informal. Someone held a gourd with a little water in it, and another held the chicken and stretched out its neck. Balti would slowly run this spear across the chicken's neck, severing it so that the blood flowed down into the gourd. The chicken never seemed to make a fuss like when I was on the farm and we'd chop a chicken's head off for Sunday's dinner. The people who brought the chicken were squatting on their knees, waiting for Balti to sprinkle them lightly with the blood and water. If someone showed up late, he'd rush in and join the others already gathered there. Before the blood was sprinkled, the spear was put back to lean against the grass fence, and the chicken was put on the ground. The chicken was eventually plucked of feathers and cooked, but it had no relationship to the ceremony so far as I could determine. It was just another chicken for the pot. Sometimes, if a person in the village was too ill to come to Balti to have him sacrifice the chicken, he'd put some of the blood in a hollow tubular stock. They would seal up the end with mud and sprinkle the blood on the sick person in the village. Almost no Masengos kept sheep or goats. When you saw such an animal in a Masengo village, you knew it was there for some superstitious reason. I recall one Sunday seeing someone come up the hill leading a goat on the way to Balti's village. They were bringing it in from home to have Balti cut off the tip of its ear and make an amulet. This tip of the ear was taken back home along with the goat. The amulet with the tip of the goat's ear was put on a string made from the fiber of the bush with a nettle and then worn around the neck by the woman in the village who had been experiencing poor health. The goat itself was staked in a shady place near to some emoi plants. Every day they gave the goat preferential treatment. They spoke kindly to it, gave it beer or fermented honey water. The idea was to keep the goat happy, so that the bad spirit causing the illness would leave the woman and be attracted to live in this goat. People were constantly coming to Balti to be blessed by him. They would hand him something like a cooked goji root or perhaps a short string of beads. Usually they knelt in front of Balti when they did this. Balti would take the object to be blessed, pass it under one of his armpits, spit on it, remove it to the other hand, and repeat the procedure under the armpit. It often appeared that he was talking casually about something unrelated to what he was doing, just having a normal, friendly conversation about almost anything. Before it was over, Balti would hand the item back to the person who brought it, and this individual would wrap it in a leaf of some sort and carry it back home to the village. It appears that the idea was to convey Balti's blessing and power to a particular felt need in that person's home or village. Frequently, we'd see young people coming up to Balti, and he'd spit ever so lightly on their chest or stomachs to bless them. When I got to know him better, I'd occasionally, in good humor, lift up my t-shirt and kid Balti that I could use a blessing too, always being careful to call it off by backing away before he might think I was serious about it. Balti had a great sense of humor and loved to tease, especially the children. People loved him, but also feared him greatly. He was a complex person. He was shrewd, calculating, and shared in one way or another in the lives of the Masingo people. His power and reputation extended to the far reaches of the tribe. When we'd be working down at the river, we'd frequently see 6 or 8 Masingo men and women passing by on the trail leading up the hill in the direction of Balti's place. They'd be carrying heavy pots of honey that they had collected from their beehives, which were positioned high in the trees throughout the forest. When I'd ask them where they were going, they'd call back without stopping, "Wanga, Wanga," life or spirit. They were bringing these as gifts to Balti. He received many such pots of honey. Some of the honey was turned into fermented honey water, into which they had shaved the bark of a certain tree to give it a drug-like effect. Others were carried by Balti's people into Meti and turned into cash. With the cash, they were able to purchase heavy old Italian army rifles. With these, they could marry, kill each other, and celebrate on occasions like marriages and especially in connection with death. A Masingo burial. We always knew when someone had died and the burial was taking place because of the heavy rifles being fired in that place. It appeared that the more important the individual, the more shots were fired. When a new mourner arrived, he'd eventually aim his gun in the direction of nowhere and fire. One morning, we became aware of a death just over the hill beyond the upper end of the airstrip. Throughout the morning, individuals or groups of 2 or 3 came up the hill from across the river. They passed through the compound and continued on the vine-covered trail leading to that village. We'd heard a few shots during the morning and finally decided that we'd go and have a look. This is what we saw. The older man who had died had already been buried. The gravesite was almost in the center of this small clearing. Women had put a small temporary grass enclosure around the mound of the grave. There were only a few shacks in this small clearing, and the forest pressed in closely. As was their custom, an area of at least 30 or 40 yards had been cleared of any vines or small sharp stumps. Several women were still working hard at that. Most people were just scattered around, sitting there saying very little to one another. It was all extremely unorganized and informal. Levine and I quietly sat down among them on a small log. It wasn't long before one of the women ran in from behind us, put her grass skirt between her knees, and took a nosedive into the air, falling flat out on the ground with a crashing thud. She was stretched out full length, with her hands extended beyond her head. This was the way Masingo women expressed their grief. Almost immediately, a couple of women rushed forward, grabbed hold of her, and restrained her forcibly as she struggled against them, bringing her back to where she had been sitting. At this time, other women were throwing themselves on the ground in the same way. It all seemed confusing and terribly tragic. The hopelessness and despair was overwhelming. After this had continued for some little while, on our left and across from us, we saw a man come running across that cleared area with his spear in hand high over his head in a position from which he could throw it. He ran past the gravesite to the opposite side of the clearing near the edge of the forest. Suddenly he stopped abruptly and made menacing movements with his spear arm in several directions, as if he were going to throw it each time. He then turned the spear around with the shaft pointing away from him, and with the two-edged blade facing his own body. He took this spear and began violently and vigorously with strong force, repeatedly, coming down on the top of his head with the sharp blade, cutting his scalp deeply each time. The entire gathering seemed to be getting emotionally worked up, with a gun or two also being fired. At that point, we decided it would be in our best interest to quietly slip away and return home. In the Sudan, we had also witnessed this same utter despair and hopelessness when people died and were buried. The early morning wailing of the women was haunting and so extremely pathetic. Now among the Masingo, we were seeing this same hopelessness in the face of death. We had long before this noted the numerous cuts and deep scars on the foreheads around the top of the heads of Masingo men. It was their way to express sorrow, and it was a proper way to ritually participate in such events. Both men and women also shaved their heads bare when a member of the family died. It was significant to us that when we asked Masingo believers how they would characterize or identify distinctive marks of a Christian, setting a person of Jesus Christ apart from people who had not yet accepted him, they always remarked that believers no longer cut their heads with spears. They had heard and embraced the fantastic good news that Jesus had conquered the power of death, set his people free from fear, and had given them the assurance of life beyond the grave, a life which would never end or diminish. Interestingly, another distinguishing mark they always mentioned was that a person of Jesus gave thanks to God for his food before he ate. And they also added that Christians no longer sacrificed the chicken. For Masingos, both of these distinctives were obviously visible and important. In trying to communicate the gospel, we had to know these customs and to learn to express the good news of what God intended for the Masingos through Jesus Christ within the context of their worldview. Oral tract-like messages on cassettes. When we began producing the oral tract-like cassettes, nearly every message, in one way or another, began with the word, "This is good news for us to listen to. It is good news because it is in our language, and we can understand it. It is good news for old men and women. It is good news for young men and for the young women carrying the babies on their back. It's good news for our children. It's good news because it is from God, the one who created the world, the God we thought had gone away and left us. The good news is that this Creator God never left us. And if we will stop and think, we will realize that this is true. It was the Creator God who has been giving us sunshine and rain. It was He who gave us the children in our homes and supplies us with the food that we eat. But we never worshiped Him or gave Him thanks. For this, He should be angry with us and we deserve to be punished. But the good news is that this God loved us so much that He said, 'I will send my own dear Son from heaven to earth to show them what is in my heart.' The name of God's only Son is Jesus Christ. We never knew what God had done, but He has sent people to live among us now to tell us this good news." These messages from different perspectives told this good news from God. Each message led up to that central affirmation that Jesus Christ had given His life as the perfect sacrifice, and therefore no more chickens need ever be sacrificed again. Jesus came out of the grave having defeated the power of the evil one who destroys and kills. Jesus has great power, and we need not ever be afraid again. He is powerfully present through His Spirit, which He sent to live with us and in our hearts. If we will put our trust in Him, He will protect us from every evil thing. And when we die, He will take our spirits to be with Him in heaven forever. This is the good news from God. And this Jesus told His followers to go everywhere in the world with this good news. And today this good news from God has come to us here. We have heard it in our own language. We must turn away from the things we know God will not like and give our lives to this Jesus who loved us that much. When Masingos heard this good news, some would respond with comments like, "Yang jet, this is very sweet," or with, "Mokunyun, it's not a lie." But it took time before some of them took the plunge of faith and committed their lives to Jesus Christ. For some, it was when they realized Jesus' power to heal and experience His loving care through the clinic. For others, it may have been when they saw Jesus behind the help they received when hungry and about to starve, but for all, it was the divine power of the Holy Spirit who, in his time, opened blind eyes and gave the gift of faith, doing it in his own mysterious way, as when the wind blows and we cannot explain where it comes from or where it is going. Differing responses to the message. For some, it was a leap of faith they found impossible to make. I recall the Sunday when many were being baptized. Among the people waiting for baptism was Gutty, a smaller witch doctor. She had had double cataract surgery in the mission hospital at Metu, where Arlene Skideman was a nurse. Gutty had been greatly blessed by this, and she wanted to commit her life to Jesus and had come to that service to be baptized along with the others. We'd sung many of the new Masengo songs of praise. The sermon had already been preached, and everyone to be baptized had come forward. Gutty remained sitting on the ground with her paraphernalia. Slowly she arose, turned away, and made her way down the hill to her stick shack below the compound. In her hands were the paraphernalia she relied on to keep peace with and to have power over the evil spirit world. It was her living and her livelihood. Village women visiting the service had whispered words of fear in her ears, and she was persuaded that to be baptized was to risk her life. Sadly, she turned away and, to our knowledge, never committed her life to Jesus. On the other hand, there were instances of great courage when new believers came forward and were unashamed of their allegiance to Jesus. Artigam is a case in point. Tom Nickel from the Metu Hospital, one of the medical doctors who visited Gojiri Clinic periodically, did a double cataract surgery. He did it in our clinic on a bare wooden table. I was his assistant and amazed at what I saw. After the surgery, this lady had both her eyes bandaged and we carried her over to one of the vacant staff houses. Artigam offered to stay by her night and day to tend to her needs. Later, she told us how non-believing Masengo women would pass by, coming in from the villages, and taunt her. They would tell her she was foolish to be sitting with a woman who wasn't even a relative of hers. They said many other unkind, sarcastic things, but Artigam said, "I'm doing this because I belong to Jesus, who wants me to help others." Artigam was meeting a real need and modeling the life of Jesus so very beautifully. This woman's case was most interesting to us. After the bandages had been removed and she could move about, she still insisted that the small girl who had helped her before the surgery continue leading her with this stick, which she clung to as she was being led from place to place. This continued longer than it should, and we were concerned as to the success of the operation. Then, one day in our backyard, Levina came out to greet her and chat. The woman began to recognize that Levina was wearing a bright red skirt, and then she looked higher and saw what long hair Levina had. At that point, she suddenly took her walking stick and with exuberant joy threw it 10 or 15 feet into the air and began shouting that she could see. It was a joyous moment of truth I shall never forget. She realized she could see again. For it, we praised God with happy hearts. Chased by a drunken Masengo with a spear. During our years among the Masengo, especially those first few years, there were times when we really were alarmed and afraid. I can scarcely adequately describe our fear and the danger facing us on that day when angry, drunken Masengos came on the compound late in the afternoon. We'd had a serious misunderstanding with Balti over an incident in which a young man had attempted to drive the Land Rover. How he managed to move it, I'll never understand. Later that afternoon, when Masengos were on a high from their fermented honey water drink laced with the bark of the tree that gave a drug-like effect, they came on the compound with evil intent. Larry Zudwig and I were sitting casually in front of the office across from the clinic when I saw a group of men coming across the compound in front of the school. They seemed excited, and suddenly Buckley stopped, crouched down behind a tree about 50 yards from where we were sitting. He raised his rifle, pointing it in our direction as he took aim. I jumped to my feet and I said to Larry, "The man's going to shoot. Run!" Larry responded by saying, "You got to be kidding." Quick as a flash, I said, "I am not, man. Run!" We both took off running down the mission road toward our houses. As we began to run, a big, strong Masingo, under the influence, picked up his spear and began chasing us. He ran after me, twirling the spear over his head, ready to be thrown. I could see that we weren't going to get away. I turned around, stopped momentarily, raised my hand, and in English said, "No, man, no," and wheeled around and ran. Two women jumped out of the bushes and tripped this drunken Masingo, whom I later came to know was named O'Shore. He stumbled and fell, and we were able to get away. Larry peeled off into the forest below on the side. By this time, our wives had heard the commotion and were making their way up the hill to find out what was going on. I nearly collapsed into their arms with the words, "They're going to kill us all." It was the most indescribable moment of terror I had ever experienced. The women steadied me on my feet, and we made our way as quickly as we could to make it to the nearest building, the outside storeroom, rushed in, and closed the door. We were worried as to what had become of Larry. All I could think of was Auca Indian. What a relief when Larry, after 10 or 15 minutes, showed up unscathed. We were now all in the storeroom, along with our little boy, Paul. We learned later that several of the Masingos, with their heavy rifles, were lying in the coffee grove waiting for us to come out. Obala, our clinic dresser, came over and advised us to stay out of sight until their anger was cooled and they were less drunk. He helped us with comforting words and by bringing over something to eat, as we were going to stay hidden until morning. Larry, Betty, Levina, our little boy Paul, and I were in the first room of the shop where the tools were. We immediately decided that we should crawl over the 6-foot-6-inch metal roofing sheets, which served as a wall separating this room from the next, which was the middle room having its own outside door. We're still amazed that these women had managed to crawl over it and get between the low roof and that wall. Once we were all over the wall, we were locked in there for the duration. There were barrels of supplies in there, and we moved them around a little to give us added insulation should the Masingos decide to shoot through the wall. We were huddled pretty closely together, and sleep didn't come quickly or sustain itself. In the early part of the night, we heard the Masingos shouting and milling about under the influence of that fermented honey water. But it gradually diminished, and before midnight, all was quiet. We had to deal with the lack of toilet facilities in those cramped quarters, so that our dignity was retained. We all managed somehow, but were exceedingly happy when morning came and Paul Abala told us that he'd been talking with Balti and Buckley and the other people in the village, and he was sure it was safe for us to emerge. Conversations early that morning with Balti helped resolve the misunderstanding, and they apologized for what they had done when drunken. They assured us that we should sleep in our regular house again, and they didn't want us to be afraid of them. We were still skittish and uneasy about how the morning might develop, and when it was time to tend to our morning radio broadcast, at which time all the stations checked in with Jimma, I tried to alert them to our situation without unduly alarming them. At the same time, we all felt that we should let them know the possibilities for evil that existed in those events. We signed off with a request that if we didn't come back on the air by noon, they should assume the worst and arrange to investigate things at the Goduri. I am sure every radio was turned in much of that morning, and that when we came on the air saying there seemed to be no further need for worry, many prayers of thanks to God went heavenward. At Goduri, we too gave unceasing thanks to God. He had mercifully rescued and saved us from a dangerous set of circumstances which, in part, were of my own making. We had learned important lessons. I personally became a wiser, more careful, and sensitive person because of what we had gone through. In practical terms, I learned that late afternoon among Masingos was a wrong time to try to deal with complicated, sensitive issues requiring compromise and understanding. The man with the spear is baptized. But the story doesn't end there. The marvelous, unspeakably good news is that within a year, O'Shore, the man who chased me with a spear, gave his heart to Christ. It was my great joy to baptize him in the precious and powerful saving name of Jesus Christ. O'Shore became a dear friend. I once tried to purchase the infamous spear he carried that day, but he was unwilling to part with it. Within a few months of his becoming a believer, he moved with his family to an area closer to Métis, about 30 miles away. He took with him a cassette player, cassettes, and batteries. And later he began purchasing his own batteries in the town of Métis so that he could keep his player operating. O'Shore won a number of people to faith in Christ. Perhaps the most important among them was Elong, the son of their local chief. Elong is the man who went across the Bako River and returned after 2 months with that knotted string having on it over 100 knots. The incident involving Buckley's wife. The harrowing experience we had had served us well in reminding us how to respond to various tense situations that arose from time to time during our remaining years working with the Musengo. One incident I remember well was the morning I came home from our morning chapel with the staff and workmen. As we were having breakfast, Levina said that while I was in chapel, she'd heard a lot of loud noise in the village just beside our compound. This was where Buckley lived. After breakfast, I thought it might be well for me to wander over there and see what the problem might be. In doing so, I stumbled into a situation that shocked and frightened me. This is what I found. As I came around the corner and out of the brush into the village, I found Buckley sitting on a log with a hippo tail in his hand. Several women were huddled together near him, one of whom had her arms tied with a grass rope so that her elbows nearly touched behind her back. She was one of Buckley's 5 wives. It appeared that she was about 6 or 7 months pregnant. Across her bare abdomen was a nasty wound from the beating Buckley had given her, and which was the noise that Levina had earlier heard before our breakfast. 2 women were sitting near her with a gourd of water, and they were occasionally using a small gourd to pour small amounts of water over her head, which ran down over her bare breast, over her injured belly. It was a pitiful sight. I sat down beside Buckley on the log. I wished I hadn't come. I was too frightened to speak, and didn't really know what to say anyway. Buckley was nervous, too. He was wearing knee-high rubber boots, had his legs crossed, and was swinging his foot back and forth nervously. His wife turned her head toward me without speaking. Her expression was so pathetic, and I could see she was wanting me to do something to rescue her. I had learned previously that Buckley was accusing his wife of being pregnant by another man. He'd been away for months, and when he returned, he found his wife to be expecting a child. He was now in the process of beating her until she would reveal the guilty person. I finally spoke softly and carefully. I recall telling him that I sympathized with his problem. I said that even the Bible teaches that adultery is wrong. But I went on, the Bible also teaches us that we are not to kill. I knew that he was trying to kill the baby she was carrying so that she would abort. After I had spoken, Buckley responded icily as he pointed to the sky. "When the sun is over there," he said, "she will talk." I left for home and the work of the day. Around 10 in the morning, I saw his wife walk ever so slowly and painfully past our back door toward the overflow pipe from the water tank. She washed her wounds and slowly returned to her village. A few days after this incident, Buckley and a group of at least 20 grown men were at our back door. It was early in the morning. Buckley was wearing his revolver and also carrying a heavy rifle. To my knowledge, he was the only Musengo with a handgun. Buckley had stopped by to tell me that he and his men were heading across the river to deal with the man who had impregnated his wife. When I urged them not to kill, he assured me that no guns will cry. He had stopped to report to me because of a somewhat strange relationship in which he respected my moral authority but feared I might report him to the government for his behavior. By mid-afternoon, we began to learn what had happened. When Buckley emerged out of the forest into the clearing in which the guilty party lived, someone fired a shot and killed one of Buckley's men. Buckley, enraged, sought out the man he wanted and shot him, cold-blooded, through the head. Chaos followed. People, men, women, and children were fleeing for their lives. We began seeing people coming up the hill from the river and passing through the compound. These were pitiful, bedraggled women and children trying to hide somewhere to be safe. The following morning, Buckley and his men came up the hill and walked past the compound without saying a word to us. It was apparent that they had large guilt feelings and were fearful that I would report them to the government. Eventually, without my involvement, the government in Métis learned about this incident. Buckley was picked up and spent a month in jail. He was then released, after which he returned to the Gaudry and again lived beside us. It was some weeks before he acted normally toward us, because he mistakenly assumed that I had reported him to the local governor in Métis. Buckley becomes a friend. Eventually, tensions eased and we were again on quite a friendly basis when we began teaching Misengos how to grow coffee and brought in coffee seedlings for them to plant. Buckley took the lead in encouraging his people to take advantage of this opportunity. Buckley himself had the finest little coffee plantation, and we became quite good friends. The day even came when he and his wife were baptized. On the day we left, I saw him cry because he was so sad to see us leave. God's ways are indeed mysterious, and his mercy is beyond measurement.